Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
On the morning of May 26, 1595, the Catholic, or the devout Catholic priest, Philip Neri, died in Rome. You may have heard of him. His body was brought back to the Chiesa Nuova, the mother church of the Congregation of the Oratory, which Philip Neri had founded. Throughout the day, cardinals, bishops, and priests came to this church to pay their respects to Philip Neri, coming and going, masses being celebrated all the time. And at night, almost 24 hours after he died, the church was closed except for a select group of people, a short group, a small group of about 30 people. These people were Oratorian priests from Rome, the members of the congregation that Philip had founded, a few lay disciples of Philip, and the protagonists of the evening, a group of at least 6 medical experts, 3 physicians, 2 surgeons, and 1 pharmacist. In front of everyone, these experts opened Philip Neri's body to find out that his heart was extraordinarily enlarged, which explained why 2 ribs around the heart were broken. It did not take long for, you know, everyone to associate Philip's enlarged heart with his intense love for God. The next day, after more crowds came to church to pray, his disciples buried his body. 4 years later, the body was exhumed. They found parts of the coffin rotten and the vestments broken into dust. The body, however, was found in a state of unusual physical preservation, as officially confirmed by 4 doctors in Rome, some of whom had already testified about Philip's heart. Saint Philip Neri, therefore, is one of the many saints whose bodies, because they did not decompose, are known as incorrupt bodies. To our modern minds, incorrupt bodies seem greatly suspicious. Is it God making this miracle? Could the body not have been preserved by natural conditions, or perhaps secretly embalmed? These questions, which are legitimate for all Catholics to have, seem to place incorrupt bodies in contrast with modern science. Modern science thrives on empirical proofs, quantitative measurements, experiments, and so on. Incorrupt bodies, on the other hand, are associated with popular devotion and the Catholic Church, and a case could indeed be made against certain unreasonable beliefs that some Catholic people may have, Catholic and non-Catholic alike, may have regarding incorrupt bodies. In this talk, contrary to the assumption that religious interest in incorrupt bodies is at odds with science, I will show that there has rarely been a moment in history in which they have been separated. Here is my disclaimer. This is not a talk about the scientific explanation or lack thereof of the incorruption of dead bodies. It is a talk about history. I will argue that this continuous union between science and holy corpses has affected both the religious and the scientific sides profoundly. Science often shaped the official attitude of the Catholic Church towards holy corpses. For instance, the Church today rarely uses the incorruption of a body as evidence for the saint's canonization. But devotion to holy corpses also had a significant impact in the history of science, especially in the advancement of anatomy. Indeed, the presence of physicians in the autopsy of Saint Philip Neri is but one example of how the Catholic Church has persistently relied on scientific evidence in analyzing holy corpses, as I will explain throughout this talk. Now, this historical union between holy corpses and science challenges popular myths about science and religion. Let me show you why, with a question I recently asked our modern friend ChatGPT. And if you have your computer or smartphone, feel free to type it yourself. You'll see what I'm saying. And the question is, did the Catholic Church forbid dissections? ChatGPT's answer is that yes, historically the Catholic Church did oppose the practice of human dissections for a considerable period of time. In the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, it continues, influenced by a general distrust of dissecting human bodies, the church discouraged or even prohibited the dissection of human corpses. And he continues, or it continues, this was partly due to religious beliefs, including the importance of bodily integrity for the resurrection at the Last Judgment. This answer seems plausible. In fact, a Google search about this topic yields authoritative websites repeating similar statements. I found, for instance, an English literature professor from an Ivy League university, as well as an article from the Encyclopedia Britannica about an 18th century physician writing similar statements. And if you go to Italy, like any tourist guide, for instance, at the University of Padua, the anatomical theory, as I once heard, will tell you the same. Tourist guides will tell you the same. Interestingly, none of these people are experts on the Middle Ages or the Renaissance. Yet, results such as these that you find on Google are enough for ChatGPT to answer what it did. Claims such as this one promote the popular thesis that religion is intrinsically against science. However, I do not want the topic of incorrupt bodies to stay in your mind as just another science and religion topic, you know, that you historians say was way more complex than we tend to think and all that. Historians of science are a bit tired of arguing against the myth of science and religion because, first, they have been doing that for decades, and second, because it is historically uninteresting. The quest to destroy modern myths makes historical research too attached to the present, running the risk of projecting modern assumptions and questions into the past. Instead, historians are more interested in asking how exactly science and religion interacted throughout history without valid judgments. Where did these interactions originate and why? What was their impact, if any, on what historical actors called science and religion, on what they called it, not what we call it? Or to put it another way, how did the history of science and the history of religion intersect in different time periods? Asking these questions in the history of incorrupt bodies is especially rewarding because it sheds light on fundamental aspects of the history of medicine. Indeed, to understand the significance of incorrupt bodies in medieval and early modern science, we also have to understand their context. The Middle Ages and the early modern period were times in which religion was the very fabric of social life, in which priests, bishops, and popes were more prestigious than physicians, natural philosophers, and astronomers. It was a time in which science and the understanding of nature were dramatically different from our own. In fact, medieval and early modern Europe was very different from our modern world. Yet it is precisely by historicizing science, as historians would say, that we can best understand how religious devotion really mattered for the history of science and how scientific theories changed through time. So before looking at our first incorrupt body, let me start by explaining to you the basic aspect of the history of anatomy. Once I was at a dinner, and someone who knew that I was a historian of science asked me whether it was true that the circulation of the blood was only discovered in the 17th century. I answered that yes, the theory of the circulation of the blood was only published for the first time in 1628 by the English physician William Harvey. But how is it possible the same person asked me that such a primary fact about human physiology, like the circulation of the blood, was discovered so late? Truth is, by the early 17th century, by this time, science had already made important advances. Copernicus had published the heliocentric theory of the universe almost 100 years before Harvey, and Galileo had been arguing for the use of experiments and mathematics in science for a few decades already. So why did anatomy look so behind? Well, I replied first that history must be read in context, which is what historians usually say, right? But this is true, because from the perspective of the long history of medicine, the 17th century discovery of the circulation was not that delayed. The reason why Harvey discovered the circulation is that he benefited from a new and historically unprecedented rise in the practice of anatomical dissections. Therefore, the real question to ask should be, why were dissections on the rise only then? So if you want to know the popular answer, you just need to turn again to ChatGPT and ask, why were anatomical dissections not popular until the Renaissance? And its answer will not be different from the one we already saw. ChatGPT's first explanation for the historical delay of dissections is that, quote, religious and cultural taboos of the Judeo-Christian tradition placed a strong emphasis on the sanctity of the human body, discouraging its dissections. Proponents of this theory often mention a papal bull from 1299 that prohibited extreme funerary practices. The problem is that this bull had nothing to do with dissections. And in fact, there is no historical record that the church ever prohibited dissections. More tellingly, when scholars started to make more dissections, they often practiced them within Catholic institutions like Renaissance universities and hospitals. Leonardo da Vinci, for example, famously dissected a patient that he knew at the Hospital of Santa Maria Nuova in Florence. He did that after the patient died, of course. So an answer that blames religion for this complex problem of the origins of dissections is especially blatant because it fails to acknowledge the elephant in the room of this history. The reality is that in human history, dissections were almost never used in the study of anatomy. In medieval Europe, university students learned anatomy from the works of Galen of Pergamon. Galen was a doctor of Roman emperors from the 2nd century AD who wrote a massive collection of medical works, many of which were known in the Middle Ages. Galen rapidly became the leading authority in anatomy, almost until William Harvey's times, and his intellectual influence can be compared to that of Aristotle in physics. Today, this medieval attachment to an ancient author may sound strange, but there were strong reasons to follow Galen. For instance, all physicians knew that Galen was one of the few authors in history who had based his anatomical research on dissections. If Galen and others before him had already observed the interior of the body, why should we do it again? Moreover, everyone who has taken practical classes in anatomy, is there any pre-med student here? Or anatomy students here? Great, so you'll understand what I'm saying, I hope. But if you know anyone who has really done dissections in class, you know, even in high school, you're dissecting like these hearts of pigs, which we do in high school. You know, even if you do that and you find that what you're seeing when you're opening does not exactly match the modern anatomical descriptions that you read in textbooks, you'll probably think that your observations are wrong, that you did something wrong and not the books were wrong. So this is kind of the medieval mindset. You can understand it better. Yet, despite Galen's sophistication that everybody knew, Galen rarely dissected human beings. Instead, most of his dissections were done in the bodies of animals. Indeed, the only case of human dissections occurring before the Middle Ages is from 5 centuries before Galen, when 2 Greek doctors performed dubious practices such as the vivisection of human beings, that is, opening them alive. In short, human dissections were rarely practiced before they emerged as a new scientific practice in the early 1300s in Italy. Thus, you may now ask, why the 1300s? Why Italy? These are very good questions. So to answer these questions, let's shift our attention to our first incorrupt body, located in the medieval city of Montefalco in Umbria, Italy. Umbria is the region of Italy where tourists go to eat truffles and drink some of the best Italian wine. There, in August of 1308, at an Augustinian monastery, the mother abbess, Chiara of Montefalco, died. You may not be surprised if I told you that at that hour, the nuns of the monastery were not particularly interested in truffles and wine. What they were interested in doing, however, may surprise you. After the death of Chiara, the nuns brought her body to repose in the monastery's main church. At this stage, then as now, corpses should be embalmed, so that they remain in respectable conditions for the wake and funeral. If nothing is done to a dead body, bacteria will decompose it. In a few hours, if nothing is done to it, the body smells bad, and in a few days, sometimes only one, parts of the body become visually putrefied. This process of decomposition is especially faster in humid and warm conditions, such as the weather conditions in Montefalco in that month of August. And if you've ever been to Italy in the summer, you know what I'm talking about. You know, a bit similar like to, you know, here in North Carolina. So embalming dead bodies was not an uncommon practice in the Middle Ages, especially in the case of important people like a mother abbess. But medieval embalming processes were quite inefficient compared to modern ones. So that you have a sense of what I am talking about, the best techniques of embalming were applied to the bodies of popes and lasted only about 8 or 9 days, which was the sufficient for a novena to be said. But what happened with Chiara of Montefalco? According to the testimony of one of the nuns who was present, which provides the basis for this account tonight, The nun's body was not immediately embalmed and rested in church for 5 days. Yet, contrary to what was expected, the body did not undergo any major decay and even dispersed a good perfume. This perfume was often associated with the bodies of saints, often called the odor of sanctity. For instance, when the tomb of Saint Dominic, founder of the Dominicans, was opened 3 years after he died in 1224, people were inebriated by the intense and good perfume coming from the tomb. As the eyewitness nun later told, after 5 days of incorruption, all the nuns agreed that, quote, the body should be preserved on account of her holiness, and because God took such pleasure in her body and her heart. Therefore, she continues, three sisters went to cut open the body, and one of them cut it open from the back with her own hand, as they had decided. They took out the entrails and put the heart away in a box, and they buried the entrails in the oratory that evening. End of quote. The story does not end here. According to Chiara herself, the suffering Christ once appeared to her with a cross, telling her that he wanted to plant the cross on her heart. From then on, Chiara would repeat to the other nuns, "I have Jesus crucified inside my heart." For that reason, that same night after Vespers, the same eyewitness told that a small group of nuns, quote, went to get the heart which was in the box, as they later told the other nuns. And the same sister cut open the heart with her own hand, and opening it, they found in the heart a cross, or the image of the crucified Christ. End of quote. That is, the nuns found what they were looking for, a crucifix made of fleshy tissue inside her abbess's heart. And don't worry, I'll show you some photographs. Encouraged by these findings, the nuns kept exploring the heart the next day. They found more pieces of flesh and nerves in the form of the crown of thorns, the whip and column, the lance and sponge, and even the nails of the crucifixion. This is quite proper for Holy Week, as you can see. Furthermore, the nuns returned to Chiara's buried entrails and noticed that inside the gallbladder there were three round stones, which they associated with the symbol of the Holy Trinity, because they had the same weight and shape. Wanting further confirmation of what they saw, the nuns called the official physician of the monastery to come over and look at these bloody objects himself. The physician came, observed what the sisters showed him, and confirmed everything. Too excited to contain this news, the nuns carried Chiara's heart to a nearby church, where, the same witness says, they displayed it to a host of townspeople, several of whom were healed by its miraculous power. Chiara's body is still venerated today in Montefalco. The skin, although dry, remains intact. More importantly, visitors and pilgrims can still see with their eyes the instruments of Christ's passion that were found inside her heart. I was there last year and took these photographs myself. You can see the fleshy crucifix at the center of a cross-shaped reliquary surrounded by the three gallstones in each extremity of the reliquary. At the bottom of the same reliquary, there is the whip made of flesh, and in another container, there is a part of the dried heart. This bizarre story related to the body of Chiara of Montefalco raises important points about incorrupt bodies in the history of the Catholic Church. First, an incorrupt body does not have to be undecomposed for a long period of time, like we tend to assume. As you saw, after 5 days, the nuns wanted to preserve Chiara's body by embalming it. Second, there are other physical details associated with incorrupt bodies that have little to do with decomposition. For instance, Chiara's body produced a good perfume and it had special objects inside of it. Third, the body and its parts seemed to operate miracles. It was this combination of things that turned bodies into special objects of veneration in medieval and early modern Catholic devotion. And for these reasons, I prefer to name them as holy corpses. It is also important to note that these extraordinary phenomena had an important role as devotional objects, but they were not necessarily considered to be miracles. Although holy corpses were enough to trigger a canonization proceeding, holy corpses did not always count as evidence of miracles, 10 years after Chiara of Montefalco died, the church opened a legal canonization process in which more than 400 people witnessed to Chiara's holy life and miracles. Yet, the medieval process was unsuccessful, and Chiara of Montefalco was only canonized in the 19th century. Now, you are probably shocked that I haven't yet commented on the idea of nuns cutting up bodies at night in a medieval convent and finding devotional objects inside her abbess. The problem with this reaction is that these actions seem surprising to us, but they were not for them. The case of Chiara of Montefalco is especially striking because of the naturalness with which the nuns touched their Mother Superior's body. As the eyewitness narrated, the sister who opened Chiara for the first time, quote, cut the body open from the back with her own hand. To do this, she had to remove some of the clothing of the abbess, roll her body upside down on the table, and push and drag the knife through her skin and bones with blood pouring all over. Even more striking is the way they dealt with the entrails, digging through the heart and the gallbladder in search of miraculous evidence. Moreover, Chiara's case was far from being unique. 10 years later, in a nearby town, a Dominican nun, now known as Saint Margaret of Città di Castello, died. Immediately afterwards, her fellow religious sisters had her heart open in church, where they found 3 stones engraved with images of the Holy Family, they say. They then exhibited the stones to what her biographer called a multitude of friars. I do not know where these stones are today, but her body can still be seen and venerated in Città di Castello. Although much of it has decayed, the arms and legs are still intact, the skin is dried up, and the hands and feet still have nails. Another extraordinary holy corpse, and much more famous, is that of Saint Anthony of Padua. Anthony died in 1231, when Franciscan friars exhumed his body 30 years after his death. They found that the body had decomposed except for his tongue and larynx, which can still be seen and venerated for the disgust of many tourists at the Basilica of St. Anthony in Padua. But what does all have this to do with, you know, with science? You know, where is science here? Well, first notice that this manipulation of dead bodies by religious sisters shows that medieval Christians were not skeptical of opening bodies, nor that they thought there was a need to preserve bodily integrity for the Last Judgment. Indeed, tearing the bodies of saints apart was not rare at all in the Middle Ages, regardless of whether the body was incorrupt. An interesting case is the separation of the body of Saint Dominic, the founder of the Dominican Order. We know this because a few decades ago, the Dominicans decided to do an X-ray to the tomb of Saint Dominic. The radiography still exhibited at the Dominican Church in Bologna shows an entirely dismembered body without the head. And the head is indeed preserved in a different reliquary in the same church. Another example from the Dominican order is that of Saint Catherine of Siena. Catherine died in Rome, and the Roman Dominicans did not let go of her body, which is still there today. But how to accommodate the needs of her followers in Siena and elsewhere in Italy? Easy. Her head was sent back home to Siena, and her right foot to the Dominicans in Venice. And both can still be seen today. Christians in medieval Italy opened dead bodies so easily because they believed that at the moment of death, there was a radical separation between body and soul. No personhood was left in the body. As St. Thomas Aquinas put it in the Summa Theologica, quote, "The relics of the saints are senseless, and a dead body is not of the same species as a living body." Then as now, Christians understood death as a temporary separation between body and soul. Again, quoting St. Thomas, "The union of the soul with the body is dissolved by death, even in the case of Christ." Now, you're probably noticing that all the cases that I mentioned are specific to Italy, and that is significant. About 30 years ago, Catherine Park, now Professor Emerita of the History of Science at Harvard University, also noticed that this belief in the immediate separation of body and soul was unique to Italian culture and theology. Saints had been dismembered elsewhere in Europe, but Chiara of Montefalco is the first known case of devotees searching for things inside the body. The dissection of Chiara of Montefalco is indeed part of a larger cultural momentum in which bodies were first opened for autopsies in other contexts. For instance, physicians opened a few bodies in the late 1200s to gain information about the physical state of someone who died. And the same also happened for public health reasons to try to understand bodily changes caused by plagues. Opening the bodies of saints was just an extension of this autopsy inquiry to the religious realm. It is just like in an autopsy, the Montefalco nuns were searching for physical marks of holiness in the body of Chiara. And precedents of these physical signs in saints already existed, but only exteriorly, the most famous of which were the stigmata of Saint Francis of Assisi, whose hands also displayed physical marks of Christ's passion. In this way, historians were finally able to solve the mystery why dissections were first practiced in medieval Italy. The first anatomy book mentioning human dissections after antiquity was written 8 years after Chiara of Montefalco's death. And shortly after this book came out, it did not take long for other universities across Italy to also use dissections in their teaching curricula. But it would not be until a century and a half later that universities in England, France, and Germany adopted dissections in their curricula, which confirms strongly, you know, this uniqueness of Italy. But let's move a few centuries ahead. The rise in human dissections in anatomy after the 1300s was a gradual thing, as almost everything in history. At first, including in Italy, dissections merely served to confirm what Galen said about the body. Dissections were made only by barber surgeons and not by the professors of medicine, only pointed out to organs at a distance and did not get their hands dirty. This detachment of university-educated physicians from dissections remained in place for centuries and was also reflected in the care of holy corpses. As we saw, the body of Chiara of Montefalco was opened by nuns. There was a physician there, but it was the nuns who opened. And the team opening the body of Margherita of Città di Castello was made of local surgeons, not physicians. By the early 1500s, physicians were still not the main protagonists in opening bodies of saints. When Blessed Colomba of Rieti died in 1501, a physician was present during her post-mortem, but his name was not given in eyewitness reports, even though they mention his great mastery. And Saint Elena Duglioli, whose breast seemed to produce milk after she died, was opened by surgeons at her death in 1520, not physicians. That is, dissections were a novel practice, but did not generate immediate change in anatomy or the care of holy corpses. Things only began to change when a few physicians start to advocate for more observations and empirical checks on Galen's claims. The most significant figure in this movement was Andreas Vesalius, whose magisterial work on the fabric of the human body showed the intellectual importance of dissections. As a professor of anatomy at the University of Padua, Vesalius convincingly showed that Galenic human anatomy was riddled with flaws and that Galen had never opened human bodies. More importantly, one of Vesalius' discoveries, also noticed by other anatomists at the time, but Vesalius was really the one. You know, his discovery would have a lasting impact on the discovery of the circulation of the blood. To understand his impact, it is important to understand that for Galen, and really for everyone in the Renaissance, including for Vesalius, veins and arteries were completely independent systems. In Galenic anatomy, the liver produces blood and sends it to the heart. The heart, in turn, infuses vital spirits in the blood, creating what we today call arterial or oxygenated blood. For this link between the liver and veins and heart and arteries to exist, Galen postulated that there was a connection between the right and left ventricles of the heart. However, Vesalius noticed in his dissection that the septum of the human heart was not permeable, thus creating a crucial problem in anatomy. One of the most important persons linking Vesalius to Harvey was a man called Rialdo Colombo, a physician who inaugurated a new phase in the opening of holy corpses. Colombo studied with Vesalius in Padua and ended his career as a professor at the Sapienza University in Rome. Building on Vesalius' work, he discovered that arterial blood acquired its specific properties not in the heart, but in the lungs. after making a few vivisections, that is, after opening the bodies of animals alive, he argued that venous blood leaves the heart, enters the lungs, and comes back to the heart as arterial blood, a secret today known as pulmonary transit. Colombo wrote this discovery in a book called On Anatomical Things, where he wanted to highlight his dissection skills over those of other anatomists, including Vesalius. But perhaps because of that, the book's last part was an account of things rarely seen in anatomy. Strikingly, one of the cases he mentioned in this part was a dissection of the corpse of one of the most famous priests in Rome at the time, a man called Ignatius of Loyola, whom you probably know as the founder of the Society of Jesus. Colombo found a few unusual stones inside his liver, which Loyola's disciples took as confirmation that the saint endured much pain in his final years. In this way, Colombo became the first prestigious physician to open the body of a saint and write about that in his anatomical work. Colombo did not find anything miraculous about the body of Saint Ignatius, which was also not incorrupt. However, the body of one of Ignatius of Loyola's friends did turn out to be incorrupt, namely the body of Saint Francis Xavier. The Spanish Jesuit died in China after an incredibly productive missionary life. To send his body from China back to Goa in India, Francis Xavier's friends had to wait until the body decomposed because no captain would accept a rotten body on board a long voyage. Therefore, they buried his body in the ground and covered it with lime, a process that they thought accelerated bodily decomposition. However, when the body was exhumed 2 months later, they found it incorrupt. The incorruption was so remarkable that the corpse was accepted on board a ship to Goa. The body also produced wondrous signs. In the Renaissance, as in the Middle Ages, it was common for Catholic devotees to steal relics with their teeth by biting part of it when pretending to venerate it with a kiss. And there is even an interesting book about this called Furto Sacro, or Sacred Thefts. However, when someone tried to bite one of Francis Xavier's toes and bring a relic back home, it started bleeding fresh blood. More surprisingly, 60 years after Francis Xavier's death, the Pope asked the Jesuits to send one of his arms to Rome, the arm that he used to baptize so many people. When the Jesuits opened the decades-old casket, one of the eyewitnesses noticed that, quote, the body's right eye was open and so fresh that he seemed to be alive, and his cheeks were too, and the fingers with which he held the divine sacrament. It seemed a miraculously preserved body, even to the physicians in Goa who wrote reports about it. Yet, despite these reports, local physicians were insufficient for the church to recognize this miracle. Instead, Rome wanted an extra doctor from Rome to confirm all the Asian reports, which is indeed what happened. The incorrupt body of Francis Xavier became one of the miracles that led to his canonization, which happened on March 12, 1622, the same day as Ignatius of Loyola, Philip Neri, and Teresa of Avila, quite the day in the history of the church. The reasons why Rome wanted European physicians to assess the evidence are many. One of them was because of their being up to date with the most recent anatomical knowledge. The physician who confirmed Francis Xavier's bodily incorruption was Angelo Vittori, the same doctor who had attended the dissection of another holy corpse in Rome, that of Saint Philip Neri. Unlike the body of Francis Xavier, whose main feature was not decomposing, the corpse of Philip Neri, as we already saw, exhibited a very large heart and pulmonary artery. Vittori even published a small booklet about this special heart, showing how medical texts about a holy corpse could build one CV in the early modern period. Indeed, Vittori was not the only doctor to write about this holy corpse in a medical publication. Rome asked for interpretations of the enlarged heart of Philip Neri from three other physicians, one of whom was Andrea Cesalpino, a student of Rialdo Colombo himself, who wrote about it in his book called The Universal Practice of Medicine. All the expert physicians were unanimous in their opinion on a possible miracle. They all agreed that Philip's enlarged heart was the result of an aneurysm, However, the fact that Philip Neri lived many decades with it and associated the original aneurysm heart attack with a specific vision that he had seemed to be possible only due to divine intervention, so this physician said. The heart attack could be traced to a night when Philip had the mystical experience of a globe of fire entering his chest and exploding inside. Cesalpino explained that Philip's fervor brought a rush of vital spirits to the heart. Now, if you remember what I mentioned about galenic anatomy, this makes sense because the heart was the organ that endowed vital spirits to the blood. But what about the enlarged pulmonary artery? Vittori and another physician did not want this detail to escape, and so they took Cesalpino's explanation to the next level. These doctors explained that Philip Neri's meditative abilities urged a more vital spirit to appear not in the heart, but in the lungs. This focus on the lungs instead of the heart means that these doctors interpreted Philip Neri's heart in light of the pulmonary transit, which was only discovered a few years ago. For Galen, lungs did not matter much for the blood systems, but for Colombo, they were the place where arterial blood acquired vital spirits. That is why the enlarged pulmonary artery, which brought blood from the lungs to the heart, mattered for their analysis. In short, these physicians used Philip Neri's holy corpse to advance their knowledge and commitment to cutting-edge anatomical research. This sophisticated interpretation of Philip Neri's post-mortem represents an interaction between holy corpses and science that was different from what happened around Chiara of Montefalco's body. If in the Middle Ages holy corpses contributed to the culture that originated dissections in anatomy, in the 16th and 17th centuries the new dissection-based anatomy shaped the examination of holy corpses. Anatomical dissections were so popular when William Harvey was studying at the University of Padua, and you have here, you know, the Padua's anatomical theory from that time. They were so popular that when a theology student named Francis de Sales fell gravely ill there, he wrote that he wanted to give, quote, "my soul to God. As for my body, please give it to the students of medicine, so that since I did not serve anyone in this life, I may be useful after death." Of course, he survived and rose to become a very important bishop and doctor of the church. At the same time, the interest in holy corpses also contributed to the new anatomy, at least at a local level. In particular, they helped to promote the careers of the physicians involved in these postmortems from a social point of view. As we already saw, Rialdo Colombo explicitly has mentioned his dissection of Ignatius of Loyola as a rare case in his anatomy book. And Angelo Vittori used his role in Philip Neri's autopsy to increase his publication record. Yet another case was that of the physician who opened the body of St. Charles Borromeo, who died 10 years before Philip Neri. This physician not only wrote a medical book about Borromeo's body, but also became more famous in the court of Milan because of that. We know this because after his autopsy of Charles Borromeo, many nobles started attending his public dissections. So to conclude, allow me to turn to early 18th century Bologna, where Cardinal Prospero Lambertini, future Pope Benedict XIV, lavished his support on the university's anatomical theater and medical library and created a new museum and school for anatomical wax modeling, the very first in Europe. As a churchman from Bologna, Lambertini was involved in promoting the canonization of Blessed Catherine of Bologna. Catherine was an abbess of a poor Clare's monastery whose incorrupt body remains seated since 1463 in a prominent chair at the Corpus Domini Church in Bologna. The incorrupt body had already been used as a miracle for her beatification in the early 1500s. But Lambertini pushed for her body's continuous incorruption to be used as a miracle for her canonization in the 1670s. Various physicians examined the body at the time, among which was Marcello Malpighi, a fellow of the Royal Society of London and second only to William Harvey in early modern studies of the circulation. Malpighi was the doctor who found with the newly invented microscope the pulmonary alveoli, whose blood capillaries transformed venous blood into arterial blood. Malpighi and a few other doctors admitted that Catherine's body was special, but to some of them, the skin seemed too dry and not as soft as expected. Cardinal Lambertini, who confessed to having left, quote, no stone unturned to reach the goal of having her body's incorruption recognized among her miracles, had to accept the decision of the physicians. Catherine was indeed canonized, but the Church's report explicitly stated that Catherine's bodily incorruption and fragrance was, quote, no longer extant. The miracles used were healing miracles. Nonetheless, Catherine's holy corpse continues to be one of the main sources of her popular devotion, and you can still see it. This episode is told in a massive four-volume work that Cardinal Lambertini wrote after working for what is today known as the Congregation for the Causes of Saints. These volumes are still the standard reference work on canonizations. It's like the Summa Theologica of canonizations. They speak of every single detail that you can think of, from canon law to liturgy to miracles. In light of Lambertini's scientific interests, these volumes are also filled with cutting-edge medical and anatomical knowledge from the early 18th century. Commenting on the case of Catherine of Bologna, he wrote that, quote, the favorable view of the healing miracles should be relied on not only because of the physician's professional skill, but also because, since they abstained from saying that Catherine's incorruption passed the forces of nature, they would have said the same thing of the healings, had they not deemed them truly miraculous. That is, the doctor's skepticism towards Catherine's holy corpse lent a favorable hand to the approved miracles. Perhaps with that in view, Lambertini listed many new restrictive rules for an incorrupt body to be considered a miracle in this book. So I started this talk by showing that opening holy corpses in the Middle Ages defined a cultural openness towards dead bodies that led to the rise of anatomical dissections. As dissections increased in popularity in the history of anatomy, university-educated physicians also became increasingly more involved in the care of holy corpses. The result, however, is that they have also rarely been considered a miracle by the Church. Some of you may have heard of the recent case of the Benedictine African-American sister Wilhelmina Lancaster. Sister Wilhelmina died in 2019 at the age of 95, and when her fellow Benedictine sisters exhumed her body 4 years later, meaning in April 2023, her body was found incorrupt. What was the result? Many pilgrims started driving to this monastery in Missouri to see and venerate her body by themselves. Just like in medieval and early modern times, holy corpses still are key accelerators for someone's sainthood. But what will the Vatican say? Perhaps nothing different from what Cardinal Lambertini once told a Protestant Englishman who visited Rome in the early 1700s. Lambertini showed the Englishman evidence of miracles being assessed in the Roman Curia, to which the Englishman answered he was impressed, acknowledging that these miracles would be very hard to refute. Strikingly, Lambertini replied, quote, that of all these miracles which seem to you to be so firmly established, not one has been approved by the Sacred Congregation of Saints, since the proofs were rejected as insufficient. Truth is, from the Middle Ages until today, miracles, holy corpses, and science have rarely been separated from one another. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.